came back. Thank you very much.
That's good to know. What a way to start a film, eh?
It's a breathless start, isn't it? It's 2.5 minutes of incredible activity that just completely sets the tone for the film. And Richard Lester wanted the opening guitar chord of A Hard Day's Night to be the very first thing in the cinema. Very impactful.
And there's that trip where George hits the deck and Ringo hits the deck. And you were saying you can see George looking at his hands twice.
Yeah.
So it's obviously...
Well, we have VAR to look at it again. If we can...
We'll put the lines down.
Yeah. So here we are running down the street.
Oh. Never run with your hand in your pocket. I think that's the...
Down he goes.
Get the TCP.
John, sympathetic. Sympathetic.
But they...
Here's George checking his hand.
George looking at his hand there one more time now. Oh, my hand.
But that's the stuff you can't write. Sure, it's not. That's the extra sauce.
I have now learned that Richard Lester did a second take, but that was the one he used because obviously it had that in it, that action.
You didn't ask George to fall again.
I don't think so. No.
We still have some fantastic photos from the... from the filming of A Hard Day's Night. Do you want to tell us about this one?
Well, Richard Lester, also known at the time as Dick Lester, but he always wanted to be called Richard, he wanted to put clutter into the film. So he shot quite a few of the scenes with or through things. So he's put all these things in the foreground here just so that when they're filmed running past them, it's like detritus kind of getting in their way somewhat. Just an interesting directorial feature. They are here. At the end of part one, we saw where they burst through a doorway and go, "We're out!" And they run down the steps. That was at the rear of the Hammersmith Odeon cinema in London where the Beatles ended up playing. And this was shot, this picture, this still was taken that day when they were filming. And George is unhappy. I think we can see at this very moment. And he's pulling a couple of V signs there. The Beatles didn't often see the pictures taken of them. They were being photographed all the time. And a few months later, they're on tour in America. He's going through some fan magazine and he sees that picture and he goes, "Oh my God, what a great picture. Because look what I'm doing." And he expressly requested that that photo will be made into his Christmas card. In 1964, that's Patty's handwriting. To Bob and Sonny, that's Bob Freeman, the photographer, and his wife, Sonny. "Don't be offended, be happy, because it's Christmas," from Patty and George. So George's friends got a Christmas card with him doing the V sign.
You're getting an idea
I've got my Christmas card idea for next year.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the people who are involved.
Yeah. Now, we saw earlier that Alan Owen had written on the script that Neil becomes Norm and Mal becomes Shake. So these are the Beatles' two real-life road managers, Mal Evans on the left and Neil Aspinall on the right. But they were essayed in the film by these two chaps, John Junkin and Norman Rossington. Junkin, comedy writer and actor, and Norman Rossington, who had been in the army game in the late 50s and was a very well-respected actor. And actually, the Beatles had met him in 1962. That was the phase of bowling alleys when they became really popular in this country. And Liverpool got his first bowling alley opened by a local celebrity, and Rossington was Liverpudlian, and had opened the bowling alley, and Paul McCartney queued up and got his autograph that day. So it was quite nice that he was in the film. He didn't remember them, but they remembered
him. Yeah. Can I do my Rossington fun fact?
You have to. Now that
he's the only actor to appear in a film with the Beatles and Elvis Presley. He was in Double Trouble in 1967.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes. Is he going Cormed to Elvis as well? Yeah. And this is a nice picture. It's a screenshot from Moving Image of Neil Aspinall on the left and Norman Rossington on the right. So you see the man who is portraying there. It's the only picture I've got of them together.
Yeah, and if you're interested in Mal Evans, there's a Mal Evans evening coming up at the Pavilion Theatre next month. I wasn't paid to add that on. Let's talk about Wilfred Bramble a bit more. We mentioned earlier on that he was born in Dublin in... 1912,
yeah.
And he had quite a... what's the nicer word to say? Quite
a checkered.
Checkered life, an path. Interesting existence.
He was... yeah.
Do you want me as the lawyer to...
Yes, go on.
In December 1962, Wilfred Bramble, 50, was found guilty of persistently importuning in two public lavatories in Shepherd's Bush. On the 6th of November 1962, he was conditionally discharged for a year and ordered to pay 25 guineas costs. In court, this is the defence, he claimed to have been, quote, slightly sloshed at the time after a BBC cocktail party during which he had been drinking gins and gins. Well, we've all been there.
No tonic, just more gin.
But he's still a light entertainment staple. That kind of thing would have wiped out some of it.
Well, it's incredible to consider that because homosexuality was illegal, and he was obviously doing something in a public lavatory and got caught for it, but it didn't derail his career. He was continued to be a much-loved family favourite in Steptoe and Son. He was in the Royal Variety Show the following year, obviously deemed perfectly presentable to the Queen.
Yep.
And now he's in A Hard Day's Night as well. His career just completely... survived that incident.
So you were saying this photograph with men only is a sort of in joke?
I think that's an in joke that he would be reading men only. A joke for the crew, I think.
A joke
that
for
one.
The crew.
Yeah, yeah. So Wilfred Bramble, his role in A Hard Day's Night is to be the mixer. Alan Owen used him as a device in which to give a storyline to the Beatles, have them work against something. And Ringo is in the canteen here at the TV studio where they're making a TV studio, and he's reading that book, Anatomy of a Murder. But he's not that interested in it because Wilfred Bramble encourages him to go parading.
Parading.
And implies that the Beatles are taking advantage of him and that they don't trust him and value him enough. So he should go out there and live a little bit. He should come to places like... Dunleary.
Well, funny you should say that. This arrived in my inbox today, which is a lovely picture from 1964 of Wilfred Bramble at Sea Point. So Sea Point is about 150 metres that way. And is one of the many local sea swimming areas. So this photo was sent to us by... this is Wilfred Bramble's niece... And her daughter is a designer who works in Greystones called Susan Bramble. And she sent us this photo and told us we could use it. So Wilfred was her great uncle and would still visit Ireland. And it just seems amazing that this arrived in our inbox this morning when we're about to play Dunleary.
Yeah. And it's the cigarette holder.
Yes.
Cigarette holder.
The socks and sandals.
It's a classic combo. You know?
Giles Martin talked about the Socks and Sandals Brigade, doesn't he? You think he's talking about Wilfred Bramble?
I think so.
Mm. Yeah. So it's the role of the grandfather to set in motion, to set Ringo out on this, to go AWOL, basically. And the chase scenes evolve in part two of the film as a result. Now, so there's a lot of running around in the second half of the film. But before we get there, we're going to look at some of the other...
We might just do a quick rogues gallery of some of the other people who turn up into the film. Victor Spinetti.
Yes, Victor in the fluffy jumper as the TV director, pressured.
He'll have a long connection with the Beatles.
Yes, they liked him. He was in Help, and then he was in Magical Mystery Tour, and he also adapted John Lennon's books for the National Theatre.
And most significantly, London Town.
The video.
He was the actor, the out-of-work actor.
Yes.
Terrible video.
In Wings, London Town, 10 years later.
I've kind of blocked that album out of my head.
Great value, Victor Spinetti. Great raconteur. Used to go to Beatles conventions and keep everyone happy.
As a kid watching TV in the 80s, a lot of these faces would pop up on kids' shows. Derek Nimmo,
another
fantastic star.
Derek Nimmo, fun fact about Derek Nimmo. Do you know this one?
He went to Quarry Bank.
He did.
Oh, yeah.
John Lennon's school. So when John went to school, there was talk of this famous boy who used to go there, and that was Derek Nimmo. And he ended up in the film.
He never sounded Liverpudlian, Derek Nimmo.
No, nothing like
it. I like the
it.
Fact that he's playing the part of exactly the sort of variety act that the Beatles swept away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Who else do we have?
Derek Giler.
Derek Giler. Always seemed to play a policeman or a janitor or something like that, that kind of a role. Very good he was.
Lionel Blair? No, we're not doing Lionel Blair.
We're not
Blair
doing
jokes.
Our Lionel Blair jokes.
No.
Lionel Blair is the dancer. He's the one who's doing whatever to stop the woman dragging George Harrison back.
George looks happy.
He's in his element. It's an odd picture because you're like, where does George start and end? You kind of lose perspective of it. It's like one of those Halloween costumes where, you know, you're carrying your head under your arm. I quite like that. And here's a good swimmer.
Yeah, Margaret Nolan. Yes. Another line. I mean, this is a youth certificate film, but Wilfred Bramble just looks at her and goes, I bet you're a good swimmer.
Fun so, fact, Stephen, come on.
Fun fact, she was also in Goldfinger that year. So she's Dink, the masseuse that gives Sean Connery a massage by the pool. Richard Vernon, that we saw earlier, was also in Goldfinger. Just yep, a man on the street.
39 years old.
Tough paper round.
Mm. And Goldfinger is the James Bond movie that disses the Beatles.
Yes.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, where Bond reveals himself not as cool as he thinks he is.
And the last person we should mention is this man.
The Beatles' real-life tailor, Dougie Millings. I don't know why he was given a role in the film. He doesn't have to speak, but he does stand there. And he's measuring one of them. I can't remember, is it Paul? He's measuring them for a suit, but they suddenly leave the room and he's left carrying the tape measure. John comes along with a pair of scissors and says something like, I declare this bridge open. Declare this bridge open. That's it, yeah.
I guess if he didn't speak, he didn't have to join Equity. I guess that's the deal. He wasn't in a train station.
Yeah. So then they're running, and they're running in Notting Hill. A lot of the film was shot in Notting Hill in West London, which had been the scene of the Notting Hill riots only 6 years earlier, Britain's first bad race riots. And Ringo had the scene on his own. This is down at the towpath by the River Thames at Kew. Still much the same today, if you go there now.
So we could recreate that.
I have recreated it. I have actually laid right there. Yeah.
And I couldn't convince you to go to Sea Point to recreate the Wolf.
I've got a few hours tomorrow.
Do that tomorrow.
And I might have some sandals in my case. So you never know.
We're going to show another clip. The thing I'm going to say about this clip before it rolls, the thing I always like about this bit in the movie is how there's an awful lot of World War II desolation in the background.
Yeah.
It's 1964, it's 19 years since the end of World War II, and London still had an awful lot of sites like this.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. It's all completely developed now, which is why it's harder and harder to find the locations. But yes, not long after the war, there was still a lot of damage, and we see some of that. I'll give you all I've got to give. I'll talk over this thing slightly. Richard Lester added a few scenes of kind of slapstick comedy that didn't... They weren't Beatles scenes as such, but they were just going to help make the film funnier. And that is John Bluthal, who's an Australian actor in London, a friend of Spike's. Lester was such a brilliant director. I mean, there's such a lot of comedy in just that one scene. Mm. And you wouldn't have missed it had that not been there, but it just adds so much, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's so neatly put together. It's so... The economy of it is just pitched perfectly.
It is, yeah. He went on to be Manny Cohen in Nevermind the Quality, Feel the Width, which was an Irish-Jewish sitcom. and he became the bumbling Frank Pickle in The Vicar of Dibley. Yeah, and he died only about 2 years ago. Mm. Yeah.
The amazing thing about the film is that they're using an awful lot of real locations all the time. There's not an awful lot of set work or stage work done.
They film in Twickenham, the film studios, and also in the Scala Theatre, but there's a lot of street action. And the station action, of course, at the beginning of the film. Ostensibly, they're meant to be coming from Liverpool to London to make a TV show. But in the end, they leave out the identities of the cities, so you don't really know they're coming from Liverpool. That narrow side street is meant to be Liverpool, but they just don't say it, and it doesn't matter. I like this picture because they're filming that Charlotte Mews in the middle of the West End of London, near the Scala Theatre. And obviously it was known locally that the Beatles were filming there. And so in the film, that woman is looking out of the shop window and the two women above are looking down, and you can actually see them in the movie, but you tend not to notice them because you're watching the Beatles.
I know. Do we know their names?
It's not Mrs. Drain. It could be her twin sister, couldn't it?
Have we tracked them down? No. And there's other important people hanging around.
Yeah, this is outside the Scala Theatre. This is so the writer Alan Owen on the left, the producer Walter Shenson in the middle, and on the right is Maureen Cleave, who was one of the Beatles' favoured journalists and has quite an important role to play in the Beatles' story, and had a strong Irish background as well.
Yes, yeah, so her mother is born in Longford, and she's raised her childhood in Sligo, and she later in life she also lived in Ireland. But she is the journalist who writes the Bigger Than Jesus story in 1966. So yeah, she becomes quite a confidant.
Oh yeah, they love Maureen from the start, and she loved them. I mean, they had great rapport with particular journalists, and certainly Maureen was one of them.
Well, I have a quote here where she first interviewed the Beatles in 1963, and this is the quote. This is how I feel about Jason as well, just coincidentally. Said, "You are outraged, diverted, and charmed, but you are never ever bored."
Oh, I'll take it.
Yes.
And I think that kind of sums the Beatles up.
Yeah. So they're filming at the Scala, and because the Beatles are known to be in a theatre in the West End of London, so there are fans outside. And here are real-life fans. These aren't extras from the film. These are girls who have probably bunked off school to get there. You see the Scala Theatre sign in the background, sadly demolished in the about 1970, I think it came down. But the Beatles fans were all ages. You know, we saw earlier how Mrs. Drain was, a great fan of them. And we see these kids. I mean, these kids are probably...
Oh,
there she is.
There she is. There's Mrs. Drain.
There she is.
She gets everywhere.
That's amazing.
But it is actually an early clue to the new direction, that picture, because what we're seeing is the fact that everybody loved the Beatles. You didn't have to just be a teenager. They appealed to people because they were so brilliant, and that has maintained to this day.
Yeah.
So inside the Scala Theatre, they're filming the live show.
They've gone there to do this TV show, so Richard Lester has rented this theatre, which doubles in the film as a TV studio. So now we're taken down onto the TV set, as it were, the set of the television show. So you've got the cameras in view because they're making a TV programme, and we're watching them make it.
And that's not the most common type of presentation. We're kind of used to seeing behind the scenes, and television would kind of go that way. Kenny Everett and all those sorts of people would show you behind the scenes. But, you know, it's interesting. You're seeing control rooms. You're seeing an awful lot of the background around it. It's a very...
Yeah.
It does add to that verite.
Because it's a day in the life of the Beatles, or 36 hours in the life of the Beatles. So if they're on TV, we don't see the product. We see the making of it instead. And that is, it's all good stuff. I mean, this is such a groundbreaking film in so many ways. So we've got two or three pictures of them here. In this next shot, although I don't think we can see it here, but Richard Lester actually puts himself into shot at one point.
Sort of Hitchcock.
Like Hitchcock did. Yeah, it's always... got himself into the film somewhere.
Oh. Well, I think, can we identify Phil Collins somewhere?
No. Phil Collins is up here somewhere.
He is in there as a child.
Little Phil somewhere.
Little Phil.
Yeah, and also Linda Lewis, who went on to have a career in music. Yeah. She's in that theatre too. And the reason is that even though they could have packed this theatre with Beatles fans, the filming was heavily unionised in those days, and you had to be a member of the Film Artists Association to be an extra. So you couldn't just take extras off the street. They had to be in a union as well. And it was discovered that some of the kids in the audience were just genuine fans, and the filming was held up for a while the union shop stewards got involved and sorted it all out. And Phil Collins and Linda Lewis were both with an acting agency.
Yes, Phil Collins was starring in the West End at this point. He was in Oliver.
Yeah.
He had a role in Oliver. Yeah. So he was a big teen kid star before it all went horribly wrong for him. He was at his peak in 64.
And can I just mention, in the very bottom right hand, maybe some people in the front rows can't see that, there's a set of bongos. that are played whenever they're recording or playing And I Love Her in the film. If you're watching the film during She Loves You, those bongos appear, disappear, appear, and come back again.
Mm. So,
Don't ruin the fun. Don't ruin the fun.
Yes. Rita, the continuity one. We saw she had to deal with a typewriter on a train.
Poor Rita.
Break.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Now, there's one of the Scala performances that isn't in the final film.
Yes. Basically, the last 20 minutes of or so of the film is this TV performance. But they shot more, and there's one number that it didn't use in the film, but it was shown instead on American television in the Ed Sullivan Show. So we're going to show you that now. You probably haven't seen it before, even if you're familiar with the film. It's You Can't Do That.
It's quite the volume.
I like that you can actually see them, the girls or the people in the audience mouthing the different names. You know, George.
Yeah.
It is.
I watched A Hard Day's Night again on Sunday, and something struck me that I hadn't quite considered before, which is that they really all do get a lot of camera time, the four Beatles. And the Elvis film was just Elvis, and the Cliff film was Cliff, and you see the shadows, they're in the shadows, but they're not really part of the action. But the whole thing about the Beatles was, and what made them so brilliant and fresh in the moment, was that there were four of them. And they all, in this film, they get equal camera time. Yeah. And quite often Richard Lester's camera will go fast from one to the other in the train carriage. It was a handheld camera, and he's going around from one like that. And what a brilliant thing that was to convey the fact that they are a group. It's a whole new thing. Mm. And we've had 60 years of it now, but in 1964, it was unknown.
But they did cut Paul's scene, Paul's fantastic solo scene.
Yeah.
Why? It's not fair.
He was just too good.
He was too good, was he?
Well, Dick Lester did say that Paul, of the four of them, Paul was the one who was most aware of what it was to be an actor, of the process, because he was going out with Jane Asher, he was going to theatre, and that he was therefore quite self-conscious. But if he's asked to film a scene, he's thinking about what should I be doing and where should I be looking, and it's less.
Yeah,
naturalistic.
They were all given a solo scene, despite what I just said. I mean, that was true, but they were all given a solo scene, and Paul's was the only one that was cut from the film because it just dragged the tempo of the film down too much.
But at least he got a solo scene in the next film.
In
Help.
In Help.
Oh, no, he didn't. He didn't, no.
Didn't get any of them.
I'm thinking, what?
He had a solo scene in Give My Regards to Broad Street.
He did.
Oh, no, come on.
Yeah, solo scene. It's like all his solo scenes in one. And yeah. What a gem that is.
Yeah. But, I mean, apart from that, they are all incredibly natural on camera. Paul okay, but George and Ringo and John especially. So.
I think that is what comes across, is that they've been together for 6-7 years, but they haven't done this before.
No.
And, you know, if anyone is ever, you know, getting their photograph taken, you're very self-conscious and you're... Mm. So one of the other things I read Lester said was he had several cameras.
Yeah.
So that instead of, you know, if they were filming us, you would have a camera on Jason, we'd do the scene, then a camera on you and we'd do the scene. But he knew he couldn't do that because they couldn't reproduce it time and again. So he was just filming everything. But it works spectacularly well.
Yes. I mean, the editing of the film is also superb as well. That was all done in post-production, of course, but he only had about 6 weeks to do it. There was a guy called John Jimpson who was the editor, and they just pulled it off in the cutting room. Quote a Lionel Blair joke.
He said we wouldn't do. Why was You Can't Do That pulled out? Like that's what they left on the cutting room floor.
Ultimately, there was an agreement that they would provide 7 songs, and that was superfluous because what we haven't yet got is a title. In fact, all this time they don't have a title for the film. And if you can see on that clapperboard there, but there's no film title on there because at this point they still didn't know what it was going to be called. So the last bit of the last 2-3 weeks of the shoot was all in the studio. And that's where George has the clapperboard. And there's this scene, this extra scene was needed. And this was pretty much ad-libbed, where John was in the bath and George gives John Junkin a shave. So there he is. And he's very clever because he shaves the mirror and said, look how brilliant George's hair is there. Absolutely perfect Beatle haircut. Go back to the previous screen, though, because John ad-libbed this scene in the bath and he's basically playing like a German U-boat commander, having seen, as everybody had, lots of war films in Britain in the 50s and the early 60s. So he's, but it's there's no script for that. He's just making it up, and it's brilliantly done.
Let's talk about the spreadsheet.
Yeah, the spreadsheet, yeah. This is in my archive, and I just thought I'd show it because Richard Lester had a £200,000 budget and brought the film in for £199,841. So we slink down.
So technically under budget.
Yeah, so they have £59 a blow at the end on something or other.
A nice steak.
£159, sorry.
Yeah, and 11 grand of legal charges, Stephen.
I like that number a lot.
Yeah, good number. Yeah.
12,000 for legal charges.
But it just shows you what was possible. I mean, the budget was enough. So next time you read that, you know, United Artists didn't want to spend any money on it, it was plenty enough to make a film that has lasted for 60 years.
Yes. Obviously, once you make a film, you have to promote a film.
Yes.
And the Beatles had their own ideas about this too.
They did, yeah. Funny you should say that. They decided that they would create the trailer for the film. So this is the first time the Beatles have the opportunity to do something entirely of their own on camera. And it's pretty left field, to say the least. Downright bizarre, in fact. So let's have a quick look at that.
You, don't be soft. We just finished making our first feature film for United Artists. It's called A Hard Day's Night.
Hey, Paul.
What? Tell them about the songs and all
that.
There's 8 songs in it.
8?
Yeah.
Hey. I don't even see.
It'll be coming to your theatre.
It'll be coming
very
to your theatre.
Your theatre.
Wow.
So we'll see you
watching.
Soon at this theatre. This very theatre.
This very theatre here. Who's in it? Who's in it?
Had to cut that a bit because it had bits from the film in between which I didn't want to show you. And also the best version of that I could find is from France, so it's got French subtitles on it. But that was seen in British cinemas and I can't imagine it would have enticed many people to go.
Well, you kind of have to be bought into who the Beatles are to kind of get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and Richard Lester shot it, but he said, I just did what they told me to do. So, in a sense, that's the Beatles' first own film.
Their own thing.
Yeah. Now, they called the film A Hard Day's Night because just towards the end of shooting, it got a title. And it got a title from, well, initially, something that Ringo said. But you can see it if you click on the next screen. You should see it there. It's on the third line down of this piece. John was writing a lot of poetry at this time and had a book out called In His Own Right. And there's a piece in that book called Sad Michael. And in this piece, on the third line of this typed script, he wrote A Hard Day's Night. Ringo had said that on some date that we don't know about, some date in 63 perhaps, when they were working really hard. They'd been in the studio all day and he came out thinking it was still daylight. It's been a hard day. Looked around and it was dark and went, it's night. Hard Day's Night. And this title was born, and John grabbed it for his piece Sad Michael and put it in his book In His Own Right. And in discussion with Walter Shenson, the producer, they were still looking for a title. What could it be called? It's not going to be called Beatlemania. Okay, but what is it going to be called? And John mentioned that Ringo had come up with A Hard Day's Night and he put it in his book. And Shenson said, that's a good title. Can you write a song with that title? So John and Paul had to go away and come up with a song, which they hadn't ever had to do before, to write to a title. And John grabbed his son, Julian, was 1 year old in April 64, had a lot of birthday cards from Beatles fans. John grabbed one of those birthday cards and on the back he wrote the lyric for A Hard Day's Night. Took it into the studio the next day, with a bit of input from Paul as well. Took it in the studio the next day, recorded it in just one session, and it became the title of the film, the title of the LP, and the title of the single.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. Their industry was fantastic, but it's industry with a very high quality to it. That's what's breathtaking. So that became the title, and this is the poster that was created for it. With, if you notice there, Wilfred Bramble is one of the pictures, which is a nice little touch. And these pictures were taken by Robert Freeman, who was the Beatles' favoured photographer. He took the With the Beatles cover, the half shadow cover. But we've got some other posters as well, which we're going to show you. Because the film went everywhere. One of the things about A Hard Day's Night is it reached all parts that would take this film. So the Beatles toured as many countries as they could, but there were many they couldn't get to. But the film went where they couldn't go. So a lot of people got their first look at the Beatles by seeing A Hard Day's Night.
And this is a great poster because you say people got to see the Beatles.
All four Beatles.
All four Beatles?
All four Beatles, yeah.
Anything strange about this poster?
Anything strange? Let's zoom in.
So there's John and George and George and John. So,
I think this is Stephen's favourite version of the Beatles. George, George, John and John. I think that's fair enough to say.
I think that's fair comment.
How could somebody make that mistake? I mean, they were the four most famous faces in the world, and they do that.
Oh, there's probably somebody who's like, oh, they all look the same to me.
With that hair.
John, not really knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the French poster. I love this title.
Quatre garçons dans le vent. Four boys in the wind, which is a literate but nonsense translation. Actually, it was a phrase in common use meaning up to date. So for French viewers, that meant four boys who are up to date.
Mm, like Depeche Mode.
Yeah, exactly like Depeche Mode.
Exactly,
yeah.
That's where they came from.
Hey, Pop.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about this before we run it, actually, because this is probably my favourite bit of the show.
Yeah. So the film did travel, and funnily enough, in America, there was just a possibility that the American company United Artists would have redubbed the voices so that American fans could understand them. That was immediately vetoed. The people, I mean, there's no sop to anybody in this film. It is what it is. If you don't understand it or you can't follow it, don't understand what they're saying. I was talking to a man from Germany the other day. He said he didn't understand it for the first 5 years of watching this film, but eventually he got it. So, but they don't pander to that at all, except that there were some foreign language versions made, and we've got a clip here that incorporates three of the translations, French, Japanese, and Spanish.
Hey, pardon me for asking, but who's that little old man?
What little old man?
That little old man.
That's my grandfather.
Your grandfather?
Yeah.
Oh, c'est ridicule, ce n'est pas le tien.
Mais si, je te jure.
Mais j'ai vu chez toi un grand-père qui n'est pas du tout celui-ci.
Ben, c'est mon autre grand-père, mais celui-ci, c'est mon grand-père également.
D'où est-ce son nom? Oji-chan, t'es mon adan, et t'es mon ftari, t'es un koto, n'a pas de nom.
Hola, abuelito.
Hola.
Y pues,
claro que sí, es un ser humano, ¿no? Pues si es tu abuelo, quién sabe.
Salut. Salut, Sheik.
Salut, Sheik.
Alors, aucun incident?
D'état.
Oh, ben vous êtes là. Moi aussi, elle dort bien avec les billets.
C'est Dios que mandó todos aquí.
Escuchen, tengo una maravillosa idea. Solo por esta vez tratemos de comportarnos como ciudadanos respetables. No causemos ningún...
Alors tu écoutes, bon sang.
T'es un ballot. C'est juste Jean.
Oui, un ballot.
Oigan, qui est le ejército?
Dorenanda.
He belongs to Paul.
That's fantastic stuff.
So, yes, so as I said, it was the film, it was the single, and it was the album.
And the word Beatles isn't mentioned in the film.
No, not at all. I mean, how clever is that? How restrained is that to not mention the word Beatles in the whole film?
So you see it on the drum riser, but they never say Beatles.
You have the big flashing light right at the end, but nobody says it.
I think there's a reference to it's them, but not Beatles. I mean, I love that restraint, because it would be so obvious, so easy to push that name into the film as much as possible. And even though this film was an American film company and an American producer but London-based and an American director but living in England, they've got that British restraint, that restraint that we all recognize from our own lives of being a bit subtle about something. Had it been an American film company, a true American film company in a Hollywood kind of film, it wouldn't have had any of that subtlety at all.
It's not only a sort of maybe a starting point for a lot of people, but it's the social history.
Yes.
It's evidence of the way they can gather people around them. You know, yeah. The same way that they have Brian, that they have George Martin, they get Richard Lester, they get this cohort of people.
Yeah.
You know, Spinetti stays with them. Bruce Lacy makes little cameo appearances.
Yeah.
There's a world that they sort of bring people into.
Yes.
And yet, sort of 20 months before, you know, 1960, they're asking Norman Rossington for his autograph.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the UK album there, but obviously United Artists got their US album.
They did.
Their business investment paid off.
Richard Lester said it was the first film he ever made that was in profit before it came out. Because the American soundtrack advance sales were, I think, like 2 million copies in advance. So United Artists were already in the black on it. It hadn't even played in a cinema yet. And when it did play in cinemas, it was a huge success.
Mm.
So everybody made a lot of money on this. But quite apart from the money, it's the fact that everything the Beatles had done to this point, and indeed would continue to do, was a triumph. And this is, we know this to be a triumph, but it could easily have been a flat exercise. It could have been something that didn't work.
Yeah.
It could have been something that was a bit of a mistake, or, well, they were brilliant, but didn't make very good films. But no, yet again, it was a triumph.
It sets a bar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the phrase that everyone knows is the Citizen Kane of jukebox musicals. So although there's a sort of slightly pejorative term there in jukebox musicals, it is regarded, this is the peak, this is the pinnacle.
Yeah. They looked at what other people had done and said, well, we're not going to do it that way, we'll do it this way instead.
Yeah.
And it all just works perfectly.
Mm. And as you say, it's their ability to say no.
Yeah.
Until it's the time to say yes.
Yes. Yeah, they really could do no wrong at this time.
Yeah, it could have been naff, I think would have been the word, and it just wasn't. And there's all these kind of apocryphal stories of people like, you know, Roger McGuinn coming out of the movie and swinging off a lamppost and starting the birds and all this kind of ripples and after effects.
Yeah, because it did go everywhere, this film. And for a lot of people, it was the first time they'd ever heard the Beatles speak.
Mm.
They hadn't necessarily seen some of the TV appearances they'd done. Mostly they played anyway, they didn't often speak on TV. So it was an opportunity for people to get to know them as people. And John Lennon said in later years that it was a bit glib in the sense that Alan Owen caricatured them in the way that they were, John as the cynical one and, you know, Paul as the pleaser and so on. But I think Alan Owen did a brilliant job. A brilliant job. Everybody did a brilliant job, and that's why 60 years on it's still such a great film.
And the other thing it does, it introduces the world to this idea of a group.
Yeah.
You know, as you said before then, it was sort of Cliff in the Shadows, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. But everyone seeing this, suddenly you're presented with this idea of four individuals, four mates in a band, and that sort of camaraderie. And that didn't exist before.
No,
so they sort of invent, or at least are showing people, this is the way a band should be.
When he was told some years later, Richard Lester, that essentially A Hard Day's Night and Help were the father of MTV, he demanded a paternity test. A very witty man. But it was, I mean, No Hard Day's Night, No Monkeys. And, you know, it's a whole genre that they're creating here.
I was at an event in Belfast just the weekend with Phil Manzanera from Roxy Music.
Yeah.
And he was talking about this film and saying, you know, this was his idea of a band. And then he joined Roxy Music. And he said they were all individuals, they were all doing their own things.
Yeah.
And he said it just couldn't live up to the ideal of four guys with that sort of sense of camaraderie and Roxy Music. You know, he couldn't get quite his head around the fact that, well, you it's not like that. You can go off and do your own thing. And it took the Beatles 7 years to realise, well, you can do your own thing. And,
yeah, yeah.
But what do you think, everybody? I think we have managed to parse out the story of A Hard Day's Night, about
we
how
have.
It grew from a band on the way up, but capturing all the right people at the right time to do the right thing. There isn't a misstep amongst the whole thing, and I do hope they get to make another movie. That would be a good idea.
Yes, they should do that. Maybe one day they should make their own as well.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay.
That's our show, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming along.
Public. if you want to take a photo, take a photo. Yay, we'll all stand up here. The plan is, as we mentioned, is that we don't have...
That was the Beatles' first film. Do you think they'll make another one?
I hope so. I hope so.